Hey, welcome to Short Fine Legs, the cricket podcast that swings from the hips with as much gumption as Jermaine Blackwood. Shout out to the West Indians for their famous win at the GS Bowl against England. My name is Daniel Gallen. I will be your host, freelance cricket writer. You can't see, but I'm wearing the old 96 Bafana Bafana shirt, which my co-host, Nono Pongolo, has been glowing about. Nons, how's it going, mate?
I'm good, and yourself, Dan? Listen, I'm really impressed about that shirt. I've got to say that it's been a while, but I think we've got to bring that shirt back. It's the only time we've tested success. Maybe we should bring it back.
I have a firm belief that a team's success is directly proportional to the shirt that they're wearing. I think it's no coincidence that England won the Cricket World Cup last year to the day of recording because they objectively had the nicest kit. People might disagree with me, but I think when you stack them all up, they were worthy winners based on the kit alone. But we're not here to chat clothes, although you look very dapper in your New Balance hoodie there, Nuns. We are here because we have a special guest, SABC cricket commentator extraordinaire, Natalie Germanis. Nats, how's it? Welcome to the show. How are you doing without cricket to talk about?
Oh, it's been a bit tough. At least we've had some cricket to talk about. Obviously, you mentioned that test match. That was it's quite phenomenal for lots of reasons, obviously. But just to watch live cricket, it's pretty good for the soul. It's good for the heart as well. I've missed it so much. I mean, the last live cricket match that I was at was the Women's T20 World Cup in Australia, right, which I was lucky enough to be there. But it's felt like years since we've actually watched live cricket. So been trying to keep busy, finding myself very bored in lockdown, I'm afraid, but trying to keep as busy as possible.
Well, look, I mean, it hopefully boredom stays your primary concern. Obviously, we know that around the world, people are struggling, but, you know, we will address some of those issues, but we had to talk cricket first. Nats, my first question to you is, what's your first memory of cricket? I mean, when were you first bitten by the bug?
My first memory of cricket is probably my father telling me cricket stories. His favourite player was Graham Pollock, and he was lucky enough to watch Graham Pollock live. It's obviously a completely different time when it was during apartheid, and the live cricket that they watched, obviously, was whites only. And he never really delved into watching players of colour. But his favourite cricketer was Graham Pollock, and he told me so many stories about how brilliant Graham Pollock was with a bat and how he was able to score runs basically for fun, the talent that he had, all those things. And I suppose that's probably my first memory of cricket is hearing the stories of history and what the South African team at the time did. And I think going on from that, we played backyard cricket. I've got twin younger brothers who played cricket as well, and we played in the backyard. We were very lucky to have a net eventually made into the backyard that we could play and practice and all of those things. So we were very privileged to have that as an opportunity. And then I think it started to grow a love for just playing the sport in general and having some fun with it. And then the 92 World Cup would probably be the thing that in terms of watching live cricket, that really got me hooked and listening to it on the radio at school and when we're supposed to be listening to our teachers and stuff like that. And I've got the Walkman, the old Walkman with the headphones up a sleeve. It's 30-odd degrees outside. I'm wearing a jersey just so that I can listen to it through the sleeve. And I suppose from a watching point of view, that's what got me hooked.
Nons and I were too young to remember that. I mean, I remember my parents being
that's
very...
That's right. Rub it in how old I am compared to you guys. Rub it. Thanks very much,
Robert. Well, I don't know what to do in high school or primary school, but I'll leave that question aside. But, you know, I'm kind of jealous of that memory because it's the same way I'm jealous of people who can really remember the 95 Rugby World Cup. I mean, getting back into international cricket, which kind of runs parallel to some of the conversations we'll be talking about later, but getting back into cricket, I mean, what was it like for you? Obviously, you were too young to really understand, like, you know, during the height of apartheid and, you know, the implications around that, but were you conscious of what a big deal it was to have South Africa back on the world stage?
You know, I think just from a point of view of being able to see South Africa play, because you have this allegiance and this passion for South Africa, and you're a fan of South African sport, and to see South Africa play internationally, especially in a World Cup, that gave me this sort of feeling of pride, and it was this excitement. It was something different. It was something new. But just as you say, you were too young to remember the 95 World Cup. At the time, I was too young to actually understand the real significance behind it. And the fact that apartheid was now abolished and the country was in a totally different space, and a space of allowing everybody to have a voice. I couldn't quite grasp the concepts behind that. Right. When I look back on it now, my memories change because now I have a better understanding of the history and what it actually meant to the whole of South Africa, not just to somebody who is just a fan of cricket. It means something to the whole of South Africa. So I look back on it differently now, but then I didn't quite get the real significance behind it, and that it wasn't just about cricket. It wasn't just about the sport. It was about a lot more than that.
You speak about that passion that you feel that you felt for South Africa, and you know, like you, before I was paid to talk and write about the game, I was a fan, and I still feel like I'm a fan, and it's sometimes in my writing, I mean during the World Cup, for example, when we lost to Bangladesh, my first draft was completely rejected because it read like a fan blog, and it doesn't happen often, but every now and then I do pepper my work from the perspective of a fan, but at the same, which you don't want too much of it, but you also don't want to lose that, do you? I mean, is it a balance in your commentary that you have to straddle, or is it completely objective? You're just, there's zero part of you that's a fan once you've got the mic in your hand.
I think there's ways of finding that balance. Little things like, for example, at least knowing your opposition, knowing something about the players, doing some research on that, getting the stats on those players, know their stories, know their history. I think that is incredibly important, because if you don't know the other side, you're only going to be talking from one perspective, and then it is obviously going to be biased. I think finding a balance in terms of not saying we and us is also important. That is something that does bother me. It gets to me. Nona will know a little bit about that, because that's something I've spoken to him about, it because him being a player makes it much harder not to say we and us, because he is a we and us. But when you're commentating, you're not a we and us anymore. You're on the side telling a story. So I think if you find those balances, it's a bit easier to not be so one-sided. You are still human, and you don't want to take away that human aspect of it, because then nobody would really relate to you. And you want people to be able to relate to you, and you want the emotion to be there, because without the emotion, you don't get moments like Ian Smith calling the Men's World Cup last year, where it was by the barest of margins. You don't get an Ian Bishop saying to you, remember the name, and it's something that you remember all the time. So those emotions are important, but you cannot be one-sided, because you're telling only then one side of the story. You change people's perspectives. Mm-hmm. And that is such a crucial part about a commentator, is you are shaping people's perspectives about the sport, about the players, about what the story actually is behind this. So telling it one-sided, I don't think you're doing the sport or the players or the teams any kind of justice.
Nons, do you want to talk about that wee bit? I feel like there's an interesting anecdote there.
It actually is, because I'm actually very lucky to have started my commentary career at SABC with the likes of Natalie Kaz and the Blue Ladies of this world, because I think on that regard, I had to learn a lot. So what I want to know from, her, she probably also doesn't know, it'll be the first time admitting this to her, there's elements of her style that I've taken on board to obviously try to make myself a better commentator and learning from her and stuff. So how, in terms of, I see that she always fighting the fight of being inclusive. Even what she said recently there, she's saying Men's World Cup, and we're differentiating. How is that for you, being a female commentator, a woman commentator, and having to always be teaching people, especially on social medias, about the changes? There's a lot of traditionalists out there who don't want the change, or are a bit hard on the changes that the likes of yourself are bringing out to the game.
Yeah, I think fighting, sometimes it's almost fighting history in a way, but it's fighting one side of history, really, because I think many people don't realize how far back the women's game, for example, goes. If we just talk about the women's game, there was a 50-over women's World Cup before the men's World Cup, 2 years before. 1973 was the first 50-over World Cup, and it was a women's World Cup. And there's a lot of people who don't even realize that much, never mind the history of the women's game, and that we've had a women's Ashes series for many years. It's changed over the years, but it's always been there. So I think trying to fight one side of history is really tough, especially when it's the, almost in a way the dominant side, really, because it's the side that most people know about. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who don't understand the value in changing something like language. So for example, when you say something like batter, I say batter. I get a lot of opposition to that because people are like, oh, that's a baseball term, or that is something that gets put on fish. But guess what? There's a lot of things in the English language where we interchange those names with other things. Like, for example, if you just look at cricket, it's a pitch, it's a wicket, it's a strip. It's got all different types of names, but there's no opposition when it comes to those type of things. Saying batsman, if I'm a female coming into the game, it sounds like it's only for men. Even third man, for example, like people will say, that's a fielding position. It's always been called third man. A lot of coaches and a lot of captains don't really say third man. They'll say, just go down to third on the boundary. And that's actually where it comes from. It was third slip that moved back to the boundary. That was kind of how it all started and the naming of it. So what's wrong with just saying third on the boundary? How does it even affect a man within the sport if you happen to say third on the boundary? It's not taking away the masculinity. It's not taking away a man's part within the game. All it is making it all inclusive for women, for girls. And you ask the question, how do I feel about it? And how, you know, of having to explain it all the time. It is tiring to have to explain it all the time. And actually, this was something that was brought to my attention at the 2017 Women's World Cup with Mel Jones and Lisa Stelaker. They brought up this, and they were talking about the fact that in Australia, they say 12th, they say third. They don't say batsman, they say batter. All these things have started to come out of the language there, and they are heaps and bounds ahead of most others. They don't say man of the match, they say player of the match. And it's little things like that that change the game for people who are not within the game. That it brings more people into the game. And I don't see how that can be a bad thing. I can only see how that can be a good thing. So, yes, it is tiring to have to explain it all the time, but I still believe it is necessary. And I still think that in many ways it is hopefully helpful to the game and to helpful to people who are willing to come into this game, which we all know it's a beautiful game. And I think we all have a real passion for this amazing sport.
Yeah, no, well said. And I mean, I always think whenever I have these conversations with women or with black people, I just think of that resistance and how when you have historically been the oppressor, equality can feel like oppression in itself. And it really isn't. Like you say, me going from third slip to third on the boundary, I don't suddenly lose whatever masculinity I bring to this genteel game regardless. But let's get to some fan questions. We threw it out onto Twitter, and Nick Friend asked me to ask you to tell about your time when you were coaching in Argentina in 2001 and 2002, because Nick himself is a cricket writer for the Cricketer magazine, coached in Argentina, and you know, growing the game is obviously something that you've just spoken about now. So what was that experience like?
Well, it started out with an Argentine side that actually came to South Africa to play against my brother's side, this side. And I was speaking to a man, his name is Grant Dugmore. And at the time, he was the head of the Argentine Cricket Association. And he actually is a South African from the Eastern Cape. He played with Eastern Province back when it was still Eastern Province. And then he went over to Argentina eventually. And I think now he's heading up the Americas, if I'm not mistaken. And we had a chat and I was talking to him, do you have women's cricket there? Just as an interest, because I didn't even really know, to be honest, at the time that they had men's cricket. But they do have a men's national team. And he said, yes, we're starting to build a women's team, but we are looking for coaches and we're looking for people to come over and maybe be some kind of influence within the women's game. And I said to him, well, I've just finished school. I'm still quite young myself. I think I was 19 at the time when we were having this conversation. And he said, well, if you'd be willing to come over, let's chat. And we chatted back and forth back when you didn't have things like WhatsApp and all these easy communications. Sometimes it was letters back and forth. Sometimes it was emails. And then, wow. You know, you get onto your internet account. Do you remember that noise that used to make when you booted up the modem? It was, well, you guys might not remember that because you're a little bit younger than me. But we had this communication back and forth. So it did take a bit of time to eventually get things going and get the ball rolling. But they eventually offered me the position of coming over to coach their national side and then also be involved within some of the younger sides and some of the boys' sides as well. And I'd be based at one of their schools called San Urbano. Now, arriving in Argentina, you know that football is a massive part of their culture. Hockey's obviously a big sport there too, but football is huge. So everybody knows about football, but nobody really knows that much about cricket. I would wear my Manchester United shirt. Yes, I am a Man United fan. And people would be like, oh, Man United, oh, David Beckham. Oh, they would go crazy. But if I was talking cricket, they wouldn't have a clue what I was talking about. You couldn't just go down to the shop and buy a bat and buy a ball. So when you're sitting at practice and the girls need pads or gloves or those type of things, those have to be ordered from overseas. This is not something that you just go down to your local shop and go and buy. There was, I think at the time, 2 grass wickets in the whole of the areas that we played in. Most of them were all AstroTurf wickets. I played on an AstroTurf for the first time in ages. It was bizarre. It was different. And it's something that, you know, you're not used to. There was the outfields had these little thorns in the grass. So when I was diving around, I had rashes all over me from the thorns in the grass and things like that that you don't even think about here in South Africa, because from where I came from, which, yes, was a privileged background, I came from a school that had a grass outfield that, yes, it wasn't perfect, but it certainly didn't have thorns in it, and it wasn't going to scrape you up and give you rashes and all those things. So it was a learning curve from that perspective, is being around people who love the game so much, don't really have the facilities, don't really have access to the game, but yet love it so much that they'll still give up their time and to play it. So it was a wonderful experience for lots of things. I learned a lot from it, and it's still lessons that I use today.
I want to ask someone, you, like you said, you've been a coach, you've commentated, you've played the game, and we've seen the rise of women's cricket in recent times. The World Cups have been incredible. The viewership has gone higher and higher, almost every World Cup. In terms of when you bring it home, how much is being done to obviously elevate women's game to where India is, Australia is, and England are currently are? Because, I mean, as we can see, the gap is no longer that big now for us to compete with those countries. What are we doing to obviously bridge those gaps now? And I know that national contracts have played a part, but what can we do to further help women's game grow?
Well, I think if we look at, as you mentioned, if we look at the women's team now, the South African women's team, they've proven that they are one of the strongest in the world. This T20 World Cup, it showed they are one of the strongest. And if we see the improvement from 2017, it's marked. You can't deny the improvement. The talent has always been there. And I think that's something that people don't quite understand, even in general within the women's game. The talents has always been there and the skills have always been there. And people will say, oh, the women's game is improving so much. Well, it's not really the women's game necessarily that's improving. It's the coverage that's improving. It's people now getting to know the stories, and it's the professionalism within the game that's improved. So now people can actually train, get paid to train and play, and not just somehow find time to actually get their training in and get ready for international matches. I mean, at one stage within South Africa, the ladies were playing for their own way to go overseas. I mean, when they wanted to compete in World Cups, they were doing raffles and raising money and things like that. Fortunately, we know we're near that anymore, and we've moved on from that. The national contracts have certainly helped our women's team in terms of allowing them to have some money coming in so that they can then put more time to the game. And that has helped. Playing around the world has helped too. The WBBL, what was now, obviously the KSL is not there anymore. They've moved on from that. But playing there and getting exposed to that and other players and getting exposed to a professional setup has helped a lot. The coaching staff has helped a lot too, because that's become a lot more professional in terms of having background staff, proper background staff that's really going to help the team grow. But it's still a long way away from Australia and England in this country because of the domestic setup. The domestic setup is nowhere near where it needs to be. The girls still do not get paid to play domestically. And that is a real worry because in Australia, I think they've got over 100 contracted players. We've got our 14 here. That's all we've got. Yeah. So that is a real concern for me. The domestic setup is not 100% right. Not everybody plays everybody. Logistically, it doesn't really work. They only play about once a month as well. It's not enough cricket within the domestic setup. So we're a long way away from that being where it should be. And I'm afraid to say that horrible word, I don't know if it's not, most people just don't like talking about it, but money. It requires money. It needs investment. Otherwise, it's not going to go forward.
Max, does the men's game need to kind of step up here? Because obviously the men's product is so popular, but you look at, I was chatting to Shabnam Ismail, and she was saying she couldn't believe that when she was playing in Australia, she'd look at a billboard advertising the BBL, and on the left of the billboard was a man, on the right of the billboard was a woman. Here in England, the launch of the 100 tournament, men and women were front of center. They were presented together. Yes, they weren't paid the same, and we can talk about the way the market works, and smarter people than me have more opinions on this, but at least the image that these two major tournaments were presenting had their men and women together. When I was chatting to Shabnam, I was like, oh, how often do you share a net with Kagiso Rabada? She's like, never. And I'm not saying that they need to train together, but when they organize a camp, when there's press conferences now with this 3TC thing, Why not include the women's game? Do you think that the men's game should be kind of held more accountable when it comes to the development of the women's game?
Oh, absolutely. Because I think if the men are not involved with the women's game, it's very difficult then for the women's game to sort of pull itself up on its own. And that's not to say that the women's game needs men or it needs the men's game. Mm. But it is to say that it is something that would help. And there's nothing wrong with information sharing. As you said, they don't have to train together. You're not expecting, you know, it's always to be men's and women's and that they always training together, one net, this net, whatever. But information sharing, there's nothing wrong with information sharing. And I think that is something that costs you almost nothing. And it's not that difficult to organize. I understand that from a scheduling point of view, it's not always easy. Logistically, it's difficult, especially when life is in proper full swing and we're actually traveling a lot more and going back to sort of the normal way of doing things. And it's very difficult to say because the men's team will be at this side and the women's team will be this side. It's difficult to logistically.
But the Mzansi Super League, you could easily concurrently run a women's Mzansi Super League.
Yeah, they've got the women's Super League that they had, the CSA League, over this last little while, but it only was over a weekend. So it's still completely in its infancy. It's still very new. It had four teams. So it wasn't where it should be, but it was great that at least the national women's players were playing within it. And it certainly gave it that credibility and the option, obviously, of other girls to learn from the national players. But it needs to be a lot more than that. I suppose it's easy to say, well, then where's the women's IPL? That is something that we are hoping for. But it is difficult to organize something like that because of the number of domestic players you need. And I think that's where it makes it difficult to organize, because if you think of even just four teams, if you have, for example, a squad of 15, five of them are internationals, you still need 40 domestic players. And it's very rare to find 40 domestic players who can play at that same level within, whether it be South Africa, India even, they also will struggle to find as many as that. Australia, yes, they'll find it. England, possibly they will, especially now with the new contracts coming through for the domestic players there too. So there is two sides, I suppose, to the story, but I would like to see more integration with regards to the women's national side and the men's national side, with information sharing, spending time together, having the women more front and center, as you said, having them more visible. And it would be great to obviously see it in more of the mainstream media as well, because I don't think there was nearly enough of it. It's better than it was. And I give credit to the journalists who have given it more exposure, but I'd like to see a lot more.
Yeah. And just taking off from what Dan is actually talking about the 3TC day which is happening this coming week. I mean, do you feel, I mean, I don't want to be too controversial about this thing, and you know that some people might see it that way. I mean, have we missed an opportunity of growing the women's game even further? By, yes, I know it's eight aside or whatever, but it is an opportunity of testing your skills in a different way. And like you said, having both teams in, because at the end of the day, it is a solidarity cup for the country. So, I mean, surely both parties could have been involved in that particular day.
Yeah, I mean, we've got the small involvement of Mignon Dupria being one of the coaches, and I think that's great for her. I think it's wonderful to have that as something that they have used. She is a wonderful ambassador to the game, and she brings a lot to cricket, and she'll certainly bring a lot to the day as well. But the question is that even enough? I don't think it is enough. The press release that we received as well said, top 24 of the country's players will be playing in the 3TC Cup. It's not the top 24 players. It's the top 24 men's players that will be playing in this. And that is a big difference. You're sending out the wrong message already by saying it's the top 24 players. It's the top 24 male players. And if that's what you want to do, if you want to have it only male, then fine. But own that as well at the same time, that this is only for the men's cricketers. Are you missing an opportunity to have more exposure for the women's game? Absolutely. There's no doubt that this is a time where they could have used the momentum from that T20 World Cup, a team that made the semi-finals, nearly beat Australia, the number one side in the world and the number one side for many years, in their own backyard. They were so close to it, and making that final at the MCG in front of 86,000 people, and no momentum has been taken from it at all. And I find that worrying. I know it's difficult circumstances. You can't put that aside. What is happening, lockdown, corona, everything, all those restrictions have made the job of the administrators incredibly difficult. And I don't envy any of them. It's not something I would like to be involved in. But are they missing an opportunity at the moment? Absolutely. And they're losing the momentum from that T20 World Cup. And it is a little sad, and it's in a way disheartening. And you do hope that obviously things will start to pick up eventually. And there is a women's 50 over World Cup that's just around the corner too.
I want to segue into what we're going to talk about for the next half of the show. But we've got another question from a fan, which I think does that quite nicely. This is from Khumza Mayibuye, and I hope I pronounced that correctly, mate. Does mainstream sports journalism equip journalists with the right framework or lens to identify and report on injustices, i.e. racism, but also sexism? So do you think that we as a South African sports media are doing enough to take these conversations and put them into homes that wouldn't necessarily be having these conversations?
Honestly, no. If I just go for a short answer, I would say no. And I take it even one step back from the mainstream media now. And if I look at when I studied, so I was at UJ and I studied sports communication, and journalism was one of those subjects. I majored in journalism. We studied a lot of different things, but did it equip us enough for South African society? I would say no, because we didn't learn history. And I don't think we didn't learn the real history. I'm not talking about the history of sport, where it started, and you know, the Romans and their games, and that's how the Olympic Games came about. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the history of South African sport, is the segregation, the different boards, the what was happening behind the scenes, why this happened, why was South Africa even not allowed to compete internationally? There's some people who don't even really know the proper sequences, even from that point of view. I don't feel we've learned the history of sport within South Africa in the right ways, and certainly not nearly in depth. And if you're a journalist reporting on the game, I think it's very difficult for you to understand a situation if you don't know the history. It's very similar to women's sport and saying that, oh, now women's cricket has professional contracts, they have TV exposure, all these things. It's easy to say that, but when you actually look back on the history, there's still so much that the women's game doesn't have that the men's game has automatically. And that comes with learning the history of what actually happened. And same with black people within the country. To say, for example, we've been following, I'm sure you guys have been following Twitter and some of the conversations that have been going back and forth, whether it's with journalists or ex-players or whatever's been said. And one of the things that I think in a way almost upset me a little bit was seeing somebody say that there's no racism within South African cricket. I hate to say it, but I do believe that there is still racism within South African cricket. It may not come from the administrators. It may not come from coaches. It may not, but you can't actually say there isn't because there's still racism within South Africa. Mm. I think it is impossible to not have racism in cricket if you have it within your country itself. How do you separate the two? Cricket does not operate in a bubble. It does not operate just within its own little space. It operates in this country, which we still have racism within this country. We still have inequality within this country. We are one of the most unequal societies in the world. How can it not still be there? It is still there. It may not be as bad as it was. I hope it's not. I hope we are moving in the right direction. I hope we are moving forward. Are we on the right path? Well, I suppose we never really know. But from a journalistic point of view, I believe that if you want to know, like if you want to feel really well equipped to tell the stories and tell them from a non-biased point of view as much as possible, it'll never be perfect. You'll always have an internal bias. Each one of us has that, whether it be gender, whether it be race, whether it be attraction, whether it be your friends, it doesn't really matter. You all have an internal bias. You can't switch that off. But you want to tell it from a place where it's as unbiased as possible. You need to understand history. And if you don't know that history from both sides, not just one side, it's very difficult to tell the honest story.
Yeah. I want to go now to we've been skirting the issue, and I want to kind of just give this little preamble, and then I'm going to leave it to you guys, because there really were two conversations that have kind of changed the discourse really in the last couple of weeks. And the first was Dr. Ali Bacher's interview on SuperSport with John Robbie. Just a background on John Robbie for anyone who doesn't know: an Irish rugby player who profited and expanded his career by representing the British and Irish Lions during apartheid. He then stayed on and forged a successful broadcast career in radio and TV. Obviously, Ali Bacher, the man who captained South Africa in the last test before isolation and then organized a series of rebel tours. And in the interview, he remained unapologetic for his implicit role in perpetuating the evil that was the apartheid regime by organizing these abnormal sporting events in an abnormal society. He claimed he was blinded by the truth by the National Party's censorship, a claim made ridiculous by the fact that he had to organize the rebel tours in the first place. You know, I refuse to believe that he didn't stop once and say, well, why is Sobers and Holding and Richards not coming? He encountered protesters during these rebel tours, that did he not ask himself why these protests were organized? And then that he worked as a doctor in Baragwanath Hospital in Soweto. Now, I'm sorry, this is not denialism. I am, and my panelists might disagree with me, but I am directly calling Ali Bacher a liar if he maintains the view that he didn't know what was going on. And I think this view encapsulates the willful ignorance from white people that not only exacerbates the pain felt by black people, but also whitewashes our role in that pain. And the second conversation was actually a press conference, which I'm now sure you've heard about, the powerful words by protest Fosfola Lungi Ngidi, who championed the cause of Black Lives Matter and said that a conversation on the subject would be had in the team dressing room. And of course, there was backlash from certain former white cricketers, Pat Simcox, Butsa Dipinoa, Rudy Steyn, and others, that then carried the subject into murky waters, which then prompted former black cricketers, including Ashwell Prince and Alvira Peterson and others, to speak up against injustices they experienced during their careers and that they still feel exist today. Now, of course, both these conversations come in the wake of England and West Indies cricketers sporting the Black Lives Matter logo on their shirts while taking a knee before their test in Southampton, as well as the simply moving and powerful segment from Sky Sports where Michael Holding and Ebony Rainford Brent shared their personal experiences of racism. So that's the background that we're talking into now. Nats, I'll start with you, and then let's get Nons' opinion. So Nons, just jump in as soon as Nats is done. It's a big question, but what is your take on the events, the discourse on social media, just what's your reading of the lay of the land in South African cricket at the minute?
You know, if I'm going to start with the regards to the Black Lives Matter and Lungi Ngidi and what he said. First of all, I think a lot of people don't realize that he was asked a question about it.
Yes.
And he answered it. He was not asked about the farmers. He was not asked about the rhinos. He was not asked about any other cause in the world. He was asked about Black Lives Matter because it is something that is topical. And I'd like people to actually understand that, is that it's not like he's well within his rights to, but it's not like he even just came out and started the subject himself. For him to say that this is something that's important to him, and it's something that he would like support of his Proteas, I think there's nothing remotely wrong with it. I can't think of anything that is wrong with it. For me, I think people will see something wrong with it if you don't understand what Black Lives Matter means. It is people asking to matter. That is what it is. It's people asking for equality. It is not politics. It is used in politics, sadly. It is used as part of politics. It is not politics. And I think that's one of the biggest problems we have within South Africa is when we talk race, automatically people say, that's politics, it's got nothing to do with sport. It shouldn't have any place within sport. No, race and racism is not politics. It is people's lives. It is people's everyday story. It is used as part of politics. Mm. It is not politics. Mm. It is literally everybody's everyday story. Mm. So for people to understand Black Lives Matter is just people wanting to be equal, not better, not even any further ahead of anybody else, not to oppress anybody. It is to matter. And I think it is incredibly sad that people, after so many years, have to ask to matter. And it's the same with gender. It's exactly the same thing. And that's something, obviously, I'm very passionate about. And it is something that I experience. And that's part of my story. I will never fully understand what a Black person goes through in this country or anywhere in the world, for that matter, because I never went through it. I had a privileged background. I came from a white family who didn't have a lot of money, but we were still privileged because of the situation within South Africa. And that is something that I'm grateful in a way, ridiculously, for, because I was lucky to grow up in a family that was allowing me to at least go to school. I didn't have restrictions on where I went, but it did mean that other people were oppressed as a result of that. And that is sad within itself. And is in a way, it puts a responsibility on me to ensure that doesn't happen again, or at least I help the person next to me. I may not be able to change the entire country, but I do have responsibility to help others. Mm-hmm. And I think when I hear that there's racism within South African cricket, I do agree with that. And I get upset when people say, oh, racism doesn't have part of South African cricket, and you can't have quotas and you can't have all these things. It shouldn't have any part in the sport. But it does. It's not politics. It is actually genuinely people's story. Now, Lungi Ngidi said, this is something that I support. I support Black Lives Matter. Now, he is someone who comes from, yes, a very affluent school, but he got a scholarship to go to that school. So he comes from very little. He comes from a mom who was a helper. You know, there wasn't money there. So he understands the inequality as well. He lived that. And he's very passionate about it, clearly, and it's something that's important to him. He didn't mention the farmers, as we heard from the likes of Boita Dipinoe and Patson Cox, and saying that, you know, this is what we need. What about the farmers? Mm. This whataboutism is not something that's going to be helping any cause. I love the tweet. Sorry, I'm kind of like digressing a little bit here, but I love the tweet that if you saw it from Blacks in Whites, if you follow that account on Twitter.
Yes, Blacks in Whites did ask a question actually today. Shout out to Blacks in Whites. We couldn't get to it though.
Okay. Well, they tweeted, and this is something that I think might help people understand. Mark Boucher, when he joined the Rhino Conservation, it didn't mean that he had any less feelings for lions and elephants and any other animal, or that he felt that they weren't as important, but he also wasn't forced to be a part of that conservation. And again,
and why? Because rhinos are getting poached more than other animals right now.
Well, I'll disagree with you on that. That's actually not true. But he's not forced to do anything else, is he? He's not forced to do it. And it doesn't mean he doesn't have feelings for any other animals.
Right.
When someone mentions one cause, that doesn't mean that they don't have feelings for other causes and that they don't feel that they are wrong. Of course it's wrong. Anybody being murdered in this country is wrong, and it is something that is a huge problem within the country, whether it be on farms or in our homes or in our cars or whatever. Crime is a serious problem in this country, and it is something that we would love to be addressed and something that we would love that would change. But Black Lives Matter is not about inequality. It's not about someone trying to be oppressive of anybody else. And I think that's what's important to note from that point of view with regards to what Lungi and Gedi said.
Yeah. Nons, just speaking into what Natalie's saying, but also kind of touching on Ali Bacher's denialism and the denialism that a lot of whites feel. I mean, I won't call out any journalist by name, but we've seen some pretty prominent privileged position journalists just deny the experiences of Black people. I mean, yeah, I don't want you to speak on behalf of all Black people here, but just your own experience, if you wouldn't mind speaking to what's been going on.
Yeah, it's been amazing, first of all, to see the conversations that people are having. I think it's important that the dialogue comes, you know, in the national's attention so that everyone can actually see what has been happening for the past 25 years in cricket specifically. And for me, I watched Ashwell Prince's interview yesterday speaking about his experience of it. I've seen players coming out. Guys, this is only the tip of the iceberg. I want to be honest and say there is so much hurt. And I think that's one of the ways to actually put it. There's so much hurt that's been swept under the carpet for very, very many, for a very long time. And I think it's important, as the country did with the TRC, I think it's time that cricket does exactly the same, that we bring all the necessary parties in one room, I guess, and have this difficult conversation. I think for a very long time, we've shied away from these conversations. And for me, it's important now what I've seen on Twitter and people almost denying every experience that players have had. And like we always say, there's always three parts to every story. There's my version, your version, and somewhere in between there's another version. And until we get to that position where I can, like Nat said, you say your story and actually understand what someone is going through or listen to what someone's going through, I think that's the only way for me to create some sort of understanding of where we are, because I don't feel that we are completely in different parts, and the Black experience needs to be brought to the table so that people in general can understand that. So it's been a very difficult week, especially for some of us current players that you don't necessarily want to be involved, because it's tied to your salaries and things like that, and we are contracted. We need to maintain a certain. I'm representing the Lions badge. And at the end of the day, I'm seen as a Lions player instead of a Nono Pongolo, you know. So it's important that we I've been actually spending this time just listening and watching other people have the conversation. And yes, it is close to home because, from my experience, I have been through it. Yes, I spoke a little bit about it last week. I didn't necessarily want to delve into it. But I think, you know, what I've seen is there will be a place and a time for all of us to have our voice and actually share, you know, what we've been through. But I think there's a lot that needs to be done. And I think we can. Ashwell Prince said it quite well yesterday and said, you know, it hurts that the journey that he went through, you know, you would have hoped that someone else wouldn't have gone through what he went through. And unfortunately, in South Africa, we're still, yes, it's getting better. There's definitely been improvements, but it shouldn't be happening to another generation of Black cricketers in this country. And that's what we need to stop. And the only way we can stop that is actually have this difficult conversation. So for now, I think that's where I can, you know, share and talk about my experiences. But just even now, it is difficult conversation. You get very emotional about it, but I just think I've been really happy to see these difficult conversations that people are having. And again, you don't always have to participate. Sometimes it's just listening and watching other people have the conversation is important in this time.
No, go on.
Dan, on the subject of Ali Bakr as well, I think from a point of view of where he was, if I think of my own experience, I was a youngster in the 80s. I was born early 80s. So a lot of what was going on, I didn't understand. And I was sheltered from it from my parents' point of view, but I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was also not an administrator within cricket. So I think it's sad to hear that he would say he didn't know what was going on, because actually then that means you didn't do your job. Your job as an administrator is to know what is going on within that environment. And is it safe to bring cricketers over? Is it something that is feasible? You do all of these studies with regards to something like a rebel tour. And within the South African society, which was completely abnormal, you need to make sure that you do your due diligence and make sure what's going on. And within that, if you did that, I'm pretty sure you would have found out what was the actual story and what was going on and how upset people were about this and how wrong it was to allow these tours to go on when we had going on what was going on behind the scenes. It's a very different thing to organize tours outside of, for example, the ICC calendar, because you feel like you want extra cricket in a normal cricketing society when you don't have apartheid. That's a whole different story. But with South Africa's history and what was going on and the fact that you're an administrator within the game, it's your job to know what's going on. So I find it very sad that he would say that he didn't know what is going on. I know Ali Bakr, I've spoken to him, I've done interviews with him, and I think there is a lot that good that he has done with the game. I'm never going to say that he hasn't. I think he has done a lot from development point of view. Is he perfect? No, definitely not. He's not perfect. None of us are perfect. Not one of us are perfect. One of us have done everything we can for the person next to us. But I find it sad that he would say, I didn't know what was going on, when really it was actually part of your job to know what is going on, never mind just knowing it because you are part of that society.
Mm. That's an interesting take. Yeah, just from a professional point of view, he would have known what was going on. Like both of you, yes, it's difficult, but I'm so heartened that we're having this conversation. But the reason why because this conversation has been going on for a while now, but the reason why it's gained so much steam is because Lungi Ngidi spoke out about it, an active player within the Proteas camp. Now, I think you look at the way Marcus Rashford had to bring the conversation about food insecurity, you know, current active player with clout. You look at the way Colin Kaepernick, a current active player with clout, took a knee, LeBron James in basketball. Former players have spoken up in the past, but once they've retired, it's easy to ignore them. You can't ignore a player once he's playing, when he's in the side. So my question to you is, how do we create a safe space for others to follow Lungi's lead? Because we saw Tabraz Shamsi tweet his solidarity, but he also included the hashtag All Lives Matter, and he received condemnation. So now if you're Tabraz, you might be like, you know what, I stuck my head above the parapet there, I got shot down, maybe I'm not going to do that again. We've seen Sia Khaleesi speak out on gender-based violence, and fans want to know, you know, where's the noise for farm murders? So maybe he's thinking like, you know, maybe I don't really want to become this athlete activist that people are championing me to be. And Norns, like you said, you're representing the badge, there's sponsors to keep happy, there's teammates, there's fans, etc. How do we as journalists and commentators, how do we create the safe space for these active athletes to speak up and be the ambassadors that we so want them to be?
Get rid of social media. That is the only way it's going to happen. Sadly, because we allow anonymity within social media, it means that it's so easy to hide behind your keyboard and just spew any rubbish. And I think one of the reasons for me, if we look at society in general, I find that people are very bad listeners. We don't really listen to respond to somebody. We actually listen to just talk and to tell our own story. And I think social media is a big part of that, because if you think about it, I sit on social media, I sit on Twitter, I can tweet something and ignore the answers. I don't have to read the answers. I don't have to look at what the responses are. I don't have to respond to them. I can spew anything. I can do it anonymously. I don't even have to put my picture or my name there. Even WhatsApp, you send a WhatsApp, you don't have to see the response. You don't have to read it properly. You can skim over it. you're not really listening. You're not really learning how to listen. We don't have phone conversations really anymore where you actually need to listen to the other person on the other side. Face-to-face, we're going to have even less of that nowadays because we're in lockdown, in isolation. So you don't have an opportunity to have that conversation. So I think if we're going to allow people like your current players to feel safe within the society and be able to actually say their piece, you need to have a listening society. And you need to have a society that's going to genuinely listen. They don't have to agree. That is the whole thing. You don't have to agree, but you should listen and allow them to at least explain their perspective, because you never know, you might actually learn something, a different perspective that, you, again, doesn't have to be your perspective. But it's just about having that conversation, because what makes your perspective more important than anybody else's? Absolutely nothing. So I think it's very difficult within our society to give a safe space to athletes to be able to talk. I think education of athletes is important. So if we go to an athlete and say, look, if you're going to be on social media and you want to put out whatever it may be about your beliefs, a cause that you support, a cause that you're getting donations for, whatever the story may be, you need to understand that you are going to receive criticism. And some of it might be warranted, and some of it, probably most of it, is not. You need to understand that and be able to sift through it and find which are the ones you should really be listening to and responding to. So I think athlete education is incredibly important within the society that we're in. And it has to be education that applies to the world that we live in today, not the world that we lived in before, where there was a lot more shelter for athletes, which with social media nowadays, there really isn't. I mean, my advice to most athletes would actually be stay off social media.
But don't you think social media also helps the athlete get the message across? But I love that point that you said about athlete education. Nons, do you guys at the Lions, do you receive education? Sounds like you kind of like, I don't know, kids, but I think it's a really nice encompassing word. Do you receive sort of like lessons or education on global political social issues?
No. So that would depend on, like I said last week in our conversation as well, is that depends on the change room. What type of environment that you guys have in the change room? Our change room at the Lions, like, we can speak about basically anything. And again, it's different backgrounds. You hear other people's opinion and it's out there. And again, it's not to say we're all going to agree all the time about those conversations, but at least we are having those conversations. So I think I'm lucky to be in such a change. But I think the culture in South Africa for sports people in general is that it's the players protecting themselves from the media, because you don't want your words to be turned into something else, or you don't want the backlash of whatever that you stand for. So as much as, for example, what Shamsi said last week, it was, yes, if you pick it apart, you see certain parts of it that you don't necessarily agree with it. But from a player's point of view, I was very happy Shamsi came out publicly and supported his teammate, because that's what you want to see. If we talk about team environments and the culture and all these things that we stand for as players and teammates, yes, it's difficult, but the support that you show to your teammate right there is to say, this is what we stand for. Yes, you might not necessarily have everyone agreeing to what is being said, but this is our support for our teammate. And that's why, for me, it was disappointing for CSA to take so long to support Lungindidi on what he was trying, because that is your player, and you basically left him out there to basically just be torn apart by the public. And those are... Yes, I think there can be more. Saka does play an important role in terms of educating players, which is the Players Association. I don't think those lessons are being taken as seriously as they should be. I'll be honest about that. They are doing their best. There is the content of how to handle media, how to handle social media. And we do have an online platform as well now of doing those courses. I mean, I think in England, for example, they're doing a great job where you can't play a game if you haven't done all those courses. So all those other courses, you know, you can do them in line. It's all, only when you have ticked all those boxes, you're eligible to be on a cricketing field. And I feel like South Africa needs to go, SACA needs to go in that route as well. But that has to come from CSA as well to support SACA, because at the end of the day, Cricket South Africa is the mother body. So it's important that I think we go that route so that everyone is educated. I don't think even the when it comes to quotas, not everyone understands what it's trying to do. And those are that's the education that we need to have, like Natalie said, so that everyone kind of understands, because that's when now the mixed messages happen and you have to read between the lines. Yes, you've been dropped, but because you hear, yeah, the balance of the team, that's probably a huge word in South Africa, balance of the team, but you need to understand those conversations. And for me, I think we need to go that hard English route of saying you can't be on the field until you've understood all these things that need to happen.
And that's not to say that there isn't room for a difference of opinion. There might be someone who thinks, you know, I don't necessarily, I mean, Black Lives Matter, not that they don't believe in it, but that isn't their fight. Their fight, they want to be as vocal in support of the farmers. That's going to be the cause they take up. We're not saying that there isn't room for anyone who wants to take up another cause, but what we're saying is that there needs to be space for these athletes to feel emboldened to take up the cause. Natalie, what can commentators and journalists do? I mean, is it a case of, you said listening more, but you know, so my job as the journalist is to listen, but then to take that, to take those words, to take Nono's words, for example, and then go write a piece. Should journalists and commentators take more of a responsibility in shaping this discourse, and how so?
Well, I definitely think they should take more responsibility within it. It's sometimes difficult because, I mean, you will know when, depending on which paper you're writing for or which company you're working for, which one you're broadcasting for, everybody has their own agenda. And that doesn't mean it's a bad agenda. That doesn't mean it's something that's wrong, but they know what their market is, and these are the people that I am selling to. Now, it's bad business to not know what your market is, and you will never survive within this environment if you don't know what your market is. So they tailor the stories and what they want from their journalists, from the commentators, from all of that, to that market. Now, that just makes good business sense. Sadly, what that does mean sometimes is that some stories get skewed or changed, or get some words that get taken out of context, unfortunately. I mean, I'll give you like an example at the TAS. I don't know if you guys saw the TAS from the West Indies, England men's test now. They had the robot camera that was just the match referee and the two captains that were there. Of course, Ben Stokes forgot about social distancing and tried to shake the hand of Jason Holden. All those things happened. But the question that was put to him was, is it going to be easy to motivate yourself with no crowd around? Or is would you prefer to have the crowd here, or is the three lines on your chest enough? Pretty simple question, can understand the question behind it. But Ben Stokes' reply was something like, he said, no, the three lines are enough to motivate us. We're really rearing to go, and we can't wait to get underway. Now, there's a malice behind what he said, but it's easy to take that out of context and for people to say, oh, he doesn't need the crowds. He doesn't feel that the fans are important. So it's easy to take it from that little thing and change it into a completely different story to suit the market.
Ben Stokes doesn't want crowds at English matches.
Exactly. That is the headline that you'll end up happening. Ben Stokes is happy to play in front of empty seats.
Yeah.
And that's not what he meant. That is nowhere near what he meant. But now, of course, he is then responsible for choosing his words really carefully. But the journalists are also really responsible for not creating a story out of nothing. But sadly, like as I said, you work for a company. That company has a market. And unfortunately, because we have tabloid magazines, tabloid newspapers, even tabloid TV shows, these stories sometimes do get skewed even more than what some journalists themselves may actually do. Mm. So I think from journalists and commentators, it's very important to certainly speak the truth. Speak your own truth as well is very important. Michael Holding speaking his own truth was powerful, more powerful than him telling somebody else's story. It was incredibly powerful. And that clip was viewed over 5 million times, and probably more now. And that was a few days ago already. It was viewed over 5 million times. So that just tells you how important it was and how powerful it was. But I would I'd love to know how many journalists, commentators have taken an ethics course. I'd love to know. And the reason I say this is because when I studied journalism, ethics was one of our modules. And anybody who has studied it should have done ethics. And I think if it's something that you haven't studied, I think it's something you should look into. It's very important for a lot of reasons, not just to protect the person you're interviewing. It also protects yourself. And make sure that you do the job that you are supposed to be doing. And for you to also think about what you're doing in terms of your own moral standpoint. What is your morals? What are your ethics? And are you willing to compromise them? You need to know those beforehand. And I think I'd love to know how many journalists nowadays have done a proper course. One, journalism, you don't have to. You don't have to. I'm not saying you have to study journalism, but I think ethics, an ethics course or a module or a research on it, whatever you want to do, however you want to do it, I think it's incredibly important from a journalistic and commentator's point of view to do that. And hopefully it'll mean that we take responsibility for our part in all of this and telling people stories.
Nons, do you want to just have some parting words, your kind of reading of the tea leaves, looking ahead into the future, now that the cat's out of the bag, as it were, we've got a prominent player who's outspoken. We've got, senior commentators like Natalie and others speaking out on this and calling for more dialogue. A shout out to Telf Advice, who wrote a quite brilliant piece on CricBuzz. If you haven't read it, please go. That is one of those must reads, as it were. Difficult times ahead, but it looks like, we talk about being on the right path. It kind of feels like we are on the right path. Are you optimistic for the next year or two that we are heading in the good direction?
I am. I won't lie that the past couple of days yes, it's the brutal truth that's been given out, and I'm pretty sure there's going to be more coming up. But what I want to, as the movement, needs to come a point where we're not just giving out gestures and just talking. It has to be, finally leading to actions. And that, for me, the first step of that is those meetings of different stakeholders and having that conversation. And then from there, you can start having, whatever that comes up from there, you start having those actions being imparted into either cricket's family or even further into society. And only then we'll start to see what we actually, if you're saying you believe in the Black Lives Matter movement, you believe in equality, stand against gender-based violence, so all these things eventually we'll have to show, through our actions. Mm-hmm. And again, we do say that as to end gender-based violence, men have to step up. Just like now we're saying, to end racism in specifically cricket, everyone has to step up so that
it's
a conversation, especially white. Especially white people.
It's gender-based violence is a male problem. Racism is a white problem.
Yeah. So for me, I think that's where really, really, when you're having your players like Ashwell Prince and other guys coming out, it just shows you it's been going for too long. Mm. And for me, we need to get to the end of it. And it starts with that conversation from our point of view.
Wow, some really powerful words here. Cricket has a long way to go, not just in terms of race, but as we spoke about at the top of the show, when it comes to gender equality and bringing women more to front and center. Look, this conversation is going to run and run, but this episode is not, because we are done for today. Thank you very much to Raider Media for producing the show. Thank you so much to my co-host, Nons Pongolo, absolute champion, all-around star, all-around great guy. And of course, to our special guest, Natalie Germanis. Nats, where can people find you? I mean, you're more famous than both of us combined, but where can people find your Twitter handle if they want to get engaged, they want to chat to you about some of the things we've spoken about on the show?
As long as it's not infamous, I'm okay with that. I'm on social media. I'm actually trying to restrict it as much as possible because I actually find that it's a bit sad in these times. But I'm on Instagram. My name, Natalie Germanis. If you don't know how to spell it, it's very easy. German OS, that's how I tell people. It's just, that's crazy. Natalie Germanis 13 on Instagram, I think just Natalie Germanis on Twitter. And every now and again, I post things to Facebook, but that's not usually something that I use very much. But I've got my email. This is something that I would like to put out there. My email is on my profiles. If anybody wants to chat, ask questions, anything to get hold of me, please do. So I love to chat to people and I love to talk to people, and I will definitely answer your email. So please don't be shy.
Natalie, you're an absolute legend. Thank you so much, guys. Follow us at short_fine_legs. Yes, I know the underscores are annoying, but short fine legs was taken by someone else and we had to make a plan. So give us a follow, give some love to Radio Media. We'll catch you next week.